This sounds ghoulish, but I have never enjoyed killing 67 people so much in my whole life.
Hello and welcome to this Short Fiction Masterclass, brought to you by Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum, in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name is Jack Attanio, and today I'm going to be talking to Mark Haddon, the illustrator, poet, novelist, and short story writer. His acclaimed novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, was published simultaneously in two imprints, one for children, one for adults, and won a string of literary prizes, including the 2003 Whitbread Book of the Year Award, the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize, and the Book Trust Teenage Fiction Award. In this masterclass, Mark is going to talk about The Pier Falls, his collection of short stories, where he relishes havoc, writes into the gaps left by myth, explores the landscape of the body, and leaves the reader guessing. So welcome, Mark, and thank you for talking to us. The Pier Falls, your collection of short stories, was published last year in May, and I wondered if you'd be so kind as to read the title story, The Pier Falls, from the beginning.
Okay. 23rd of July, 1970, the end of the afternoon. A cool breeze off the channel, a mackerel sky overhead, and far out, a column of sunlight falling onto a trawler, as if God had picked it out for some kind of blessing. The upper stories of the Regency buildings along the front sit above a gaudy rank of coffee houses and fish bars and knick-knack shops with striped awnings selling 99s and dried seahorses in cellophane envelopes. The names of the hotels are writ large in neon and weatherproof paint. The Excelsior, the Camden, the Royal. The word Royal is missing an O. Gulls wheel and cry. 2,000 people saunter along the prom, some carrying towels and tizer to the beach, others pausing to put a shilling in the telescope or to lean against a balustrade whose pistachio-green paint has blistered and popped in 100 years of salt air. A girl picks up a wafer from a dropped ice cream cone and lifts into the wind. On the beach, a portly woman hammers a windbreak into the sand with the heel of a shoe, while a pair of freckled twins build a fort from sand and lolly sticks. The deck chair man is collecting rentals, doling out change from a leather pouch at his hip. "No deeper than your waist," shouts the father. "Susan, no deeper than your waist." The air on the pier is thick with the smell of engine grease and fried onions spooned onto hot dogs. The boys from the ticket booth ride shotgun on the rubber rims of the bumper cars, the contacts scraping and sparking on the live chicken wire nailed to the roof above their heads. A barrel organ plays Strauss waltzes on repeat. 9 minutes to 5. Ozone and sea sparkle and carnival license. This is how it begins. A rivet fails. One of 8 which should clamp the joint between 2 weight-bearing girders on the western side of the pier. 5 have sheared already in heavy January seas earlier this year. There is a faint tremor underfoot, as if a suitcase or a stepladder has been dropped somewhere nearby. No one takes any notice. There are now 2 rivets holding the tonnage previously supported by 8.
Thank you. And when a rivet fails, it begins an inevitable collapse, a kind of decline into the sea, descent. And you continue, the story continues in really unflinching forensic detail of what happens next. The collapse not just of the pier, but of the lives of the survivors and the people surrounding them. Could you tell me what inspired the story?
I had been trying to write for many years something about the holidays that my sister and I took for 1 week every summer with our paternal grandparents. Mm-hmm. You went on an old-fashioned working-class fortnight every year. Mm-hmm. We stayed in a boarding house in Brighton. Every time I tried to write about it, it came out too nice, too twee, too respectful. And there were things I couldn't remember. And did I fill those holes by making things up, or did I just say I couldn't remember things? I couldn't find a way of making it work. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't remember when it happened, but it occurred to me in a moment of joyous revelation that on paper, destroying something requires the same kind of loving attention to detail as building something up. And I realised that if I took all those experiences of those holidays in the 1970s mm-hmm. and I put them into this kind of story, I can in fact walk all over them in 10-league boots and smash it all to pieces. But I still have to look very carefully about the blistered pistachio paint and the uh-huh. ice cream and the hot dogs.
Yes.
And it did two things for me. One, it sort of, it released me. I didn't have to follow any rules now. I could just make an appalling mess, as it were. And on the other hand, of course, it builds immediately some high tension into the story.
Absolutely.
As soon as you start a pier collapsing, you know where it's going to go. I mean, I have to say, this sounds ghoulish, but I have never enjoyed killing 67 people so much in my whole life.
Uh-huh. I can sense that. And the aftershock of the pier falling into the sea seems to reverberate through the whole collection in a way, because there are all kinds of collapses going on in between people's relationships, but also with individuals. This kind of descent happens in lots of stories, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think the collection as a whole was inspired by my long-standing dissatisfaction with a lot of the short stories that I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get sort of Granter every quarter, or I'd read McSweeney's, and I was getting through a lot of short stories. But by and large, the orthodox kind of short story that I was reading, both from both sides of the Atlantic, was in the sort of Chekhovian, Carter, Mansfield, Joyce kind of tradition, mm-hmm. quite minimal and melancholic.
Modest events with a modest epiphany.
Yes, and often not stories so much as turning points in larger stories which lay outside the frame, which mm-hmm. you couldn't see. And I think because when you're talking about Chekhov or Carver, it takes quite a while for you to say quietly to yourself, I don't really like these stories.
Mm-hmm.
But when I realised that I could say that to myself, when I could realise I could go back in a way to the 19th century or to a few other writers I really admire who really focus on event.
Yeah.
Then when I realised I could do that, I knew how to write my kind of short story.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to think about finely tuned mood and atmosphere. I could really think about things happening. And if you want things to happen in the very short space of a short story, you've got to get up a lot of speed on the runway. And you need usually fairly dark things to happen, because it's death and all those smaller finitudes which drive stories, isn't it?
And something about the fates as well. You talk about time forking and fracturing.
Mm.
And the fact that things that happen can set off a whole stream of events that cause absolute havoc in the lives and the consciousnesses. Sometimes it can be a mental breakdown, sometimes it can be a physical breakdown. But those things that happen almost, it's like a rivet fails in somebody's life.
Yes, but I think talking about it in the abstract like this, it could make it slightly ghoulish, as if I'm sort of rubbernecking at human tragedy.
Mm.
But for me, an important part of compassion for other human beings is being able to look at the very worst
mm.
and keep on looking and keep on asking questions. And not turning away. Maybe that's
yeah.
a good way of putting it.
I
never want to turn away from human suffering.
Mm. And I think I use the word unflinching, and I think that's where we go with your short stories. We look at it and somehow you make it bearable. Because of the detail, because of the finely wrought love of objects of physicality that come into the stories, there is a sense of, yes, we recognise this, yes, we can be there because you create it for us. There's
I think
a kind
also,
of
if you,
space.
If you have ever been in a very, very dark place yourself, or if you know people who've been in a very, very dark place, one of the ways out of a dark place is to talk
mm.
and to actually put into words what you're going through.
Mm.
So I think that's what I mean by the compassion,
yeah,
and the unflinchingness. It's a way out of a dark place. To
to
explore a dark place and to admit that you're in a dark place is the first way of leaving a dark place.
That happens in your final story, which is the most redemptive one, I think, the way where Ian finds his solid recording angel in Kelly, and he talks to her, and somehow he feels that nothing is ever lost, is it, in that sense?
Yes. On a more mundane level, I wrote that story in part because Soss, my partner and first and best editor, said to me, Mark, Could you write at least one story
in
which no one dies?
It's true, no one dies. I hadn't thought.
Two dogs die, I can.
Yes, they die. Leo and Fran die.
And in fact, in the Pier 4, there is a little, games, you would call it an Easter egg. There's a little Easter egg there for my lovely agent, Claire Alexander, who is still slightly upset about the dog dying in Curious Incident.
Uh-huh.
She's had a series of dogs herself. She loves dogs. And despite all these people dying on the pier, there is one, there's a dog that escapes.
Mm.
And only Claire and I really know what that scene is about.
Yes. Okay. You know, there are moments there, even though very dark, like the boy who was saved by the nurse who isn't afraid, even though he's traumatised for the rest of his life, he keeps in touch with her. So that there are little moments of light, and I think those are really beautifully wrought, because there's a kind of a lack of safety that you introduce into all your stories. Mm. There's a kind of a sense of the darkness around the edges of the everyday, and home, for example, they're uncanny, and Heimlich, they're not... Home isn't a very safe place, is it, in your stories?
I think a safe home doesn't really generate stories at all, does it?
No.
I mean, if you look at many of the theories about the seven types of stories, they aren't all stories meant to be about leaving home, fighting a monster, and finding another home.
Yes.
So if home is not driving you out, then you don't really have a story to tell. Do you? So an unhappy home is a very fruitful place to look for stories.
Yet many of your characters' adult children returning home to the place that they try to escape from, like Carol in Breeze or the adult children in Wodwow, they're coming back and they don't want to come back.
I think one of the things I've learnt over the years, I mean, you can't, I hope until my dying day I'll carry on learning how to write, and
yes,
I won't stop learning how to write. And it's taken many, many, many years for me to learn something very simple and obvious and quite brutal, which is you have to make people suffer to create stories.
Yes.
They have to be, I've tried to boil it down when I'm teaching to the smallest formula that I can think of, and they usually come up with something like, fiction is bad things happening to flawed people.
Yes.
And there's two variables there. There's the flaws and the bad things. And you can turn the knob up on either of those.
Mm-hmm.
And the knob is turned up quite high here in terms of bad things happening to people.
Mm.
Something else occurs to me as I say that. I had a really good joint event with Daisy Johnson, short story writer, whose Sven came out last year, I think. A really wonderful collection. And someone in the audience said, why is there so much death in your stories? And I said, death is the reason why things matter to us, isn't it?
It's the
fact that we only have a finite amount of time. We will grow old. We will lose people. We're not here forever. Only because things are parceled out to us in small amounts do they really matter. If we could live forever, it would be meaningless. Then I turned to Daisy and I said, I've just realised all your stories are about death because you're 22 and I'm 54.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for two groups of people, and sex in Daisy's stories has the same function. Things matter because your body is just raging with hormones, because you're growing into the world, because you're desperately hungry for the world and for other people and for experience. I think that means that I'm over the hump and I'm going down the other side and death is the driver now.
Possibly. I mean, you torture your characters' bodies, don't you? There's a lot of objection, there's a lot of physical collapse as well as the mental collapse in your stories. I'm thinking of the character in The Island, which is based on Ariadne and Theseus, or Bunny, who's eating himself to death.
I do feel disappointed when I read novels or stories in which there's no physical world and no physical bodies.
Mm.
It'd be unfair to choose examples, but I can think of many where I'll read 200 pages and it's conversation, ideas and feelings.
Mm.
I like to locate the stories that I write and the stories I read in a physical space. I can't write a scene without putting it in a room or a landscape. And similarly, I can't write a person without them
putting them in a body.
In a body. And they're stories in which bad things happen. So the landscape of the body gives you another place in which things can go wrong.
I find it very courageous. I find it really intense and almost abject, the kind of the physical suffering that some of these characters go through. And I think, for example, Gavin in What Woe is a very good example of that. Could you tell us a little bit about the story? I'll ask you to read a bit of it, but could you tell us a little bit about the story, What Woe?
What Woe is a contemporary version of Gawain and the Green Knight, mm-hmm. the sort of famous 14th century, early Middle English classic poem. I have been trying for many years to think of a way of writing a contemporary version of it. In fact, prior to this, I was trying to write a play. It just it wasn't working for a number of reasons. And I can't remember how, but I finally settled on this particular version, the one I've written. And it grew out of the same idea which inspired the Ariadne story, the island as well. I'm particularly interested when I go back to mythical stories, to early literature, which I enjoy greatly reading. I particularly enjoy finding a story in which there's a gap or there's a hole, something hasn't been written. It's quite often women's experience in those stories. Yeah. In the story of Ariadne and Theseus, she's just dumped on an island and left. Mm-hmm. And you never hear about that experience on an island. I thought, there's another woman's experience which has been just written off. And I thought, I'm interested in that. I'd like to tell that story. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in Gawain and the Green Knight, it starts with King Arthur on Christmas Eve saying, I need a game or a story to entertain me before we sit down to eat. The Green Knight comes in through the oaken doors and says, someone chop off my head and I'll chop off their head next year. Mm-hmm. And Gawain says, of course I'll do that, I'll chop off your head. And then the Green Knight picks up his head and his head says, I'll see you next Christmas. Now, in the original, there's a very short space between the two Christmases. The poet is really only interested in the interactions between Gawain and the Green Knight at one Christmas and then the next. Then I thought to myself, that year in between those two points, what would happen to you?
Yes.
If you knew you'd killed someone, but they'd got up off the floor and walked away.
And they come to life.
And you were going to be killed next Christmas.
Yes.
And on top of that, once I got that model, that sort of receptacle into which I could place things, two other things came to me to help drive the story. One was the house and the family at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I grew up among those kind of people in the English Shires. The house is not a million miles away from the house where my parents used to live. And there is a perverse joy in returning to a childhood home and causing the most appalling amount of havoc.
Yes. Real havoc.
And in parallel to that, Gavin is quite like some of the people I was at school with. Mm-hmm. Unjustified overconfidence, a man who cares only really for himself, cares very little for other people. Mm-hmm. And it was childishly enjoyable to put someone like that completely through the ringer on paper. And B, he is exactly the person that needs to be put through the ringer
Absolutely.
In that particular story, because on one level, Gawain and my version are about how we treat people who are complete strangers.
Yes.
The people we see as the other.
The other, exactly.
The people we reject. And it's not very explicit in the story, but in a way, he treats a stranger badly and he becomes a stranger
and
himself.
He becomes the outsider.
And we end the story with him not knowing whether he will be treated kindly or not.
Yes. Yes, he's the outsider in his own home. He's knocking on his own window, trying to get in.
I've had a few sort of puzzled and cross people asking me about the end of that story. Because they want it wrapped up.
I thought it was a perfect ending. It ended where it needed to end.
Yes,
where you know that there are several things that could happen, but the story has already happened. And he's transformed, isn't he? He is transformed.
We hope so.
Experience.
I've always liked ambiguous endings. Mm-hmm. I always thought the ending of Curious Incident was ambiguous.
Yes.
Although, ironically, every reader decides that it isn't, but they decide differently that it isn't. Mm.
So they make their own ending.
Yes. I mean, so this is a little footnote, but I think it relates to what we were saying there. The stage version of Curious, at the end, it ends with the same words. I think Christopher says something like, sure, I can do anything, can't I? Can't I? There's a very long hole before the lights go out. And both to me and to and Simon, who adapted the script, and to everyone involved in it. We know that it's ambiguous, and the longer you hold that question without it being answered, the pricklier it is and the more uncomfortable it is. Most English adult audiences sort of understand that. If you have a group of teenagers in, quite often when he says, "Can I do anything?" "I can do anything, can't I?" And someone in the audience will shout, "Yes!" Yeah. And in America, that's much more common as well,
I imagine.
On the other hand, at one of the relaxed performances, where a lot of people in the audience had kind of were struggling with disabilities not a mile away, miles away from Christopher, on one occasion, the actor said, "I can do anything, can't I?" And a little voice came from the auditorium saying, "No!" So, in spite of readers really wanting to lock down a meaning at the end of the story, I feel committed to making sure that different readers will lock it down in different ways.
That seems an essential definition of art, doesn't it? That people will bring that to it. Would you read us some of the story? I've chosen a place for you to begin, which is in the middle of the climax of the first part of the story. If you wouldn't mind, Mark, if you wouldn't mind just explaining what has happened in the story so far. We've got to the point where Gavin's got the gun.
So, this family have gathered for Christmas in a sort of the snow-covered English shires in their sort of sandstone and thatched house. Martin is the paterfamilias, and Gavin is his son. And the stranger has come in. He's a black man, but with an unidentifiable accent, who also sort of smells slightly of the Eastern Steppe as well. They have a sense that he might have come from Mongolia rather than Hackney or the Caribbean or God knows where. He is a kind of universal stranger, exactly the kind of man that a lot of the extremely conservative, dare I say, bigoted inhabitants of that kind of village really don't want to be stepping through their French windows on Christmas Eve. And he has, instead of an axe in the original, he has a sawn-off shotgun with him. And he's put it on the table and it said, "Who would like to take my challenge? Shoot me with the gun.
Play my game.
Play my game." I think that's sufficient introduction, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Martin reaches towards his son, and this is when it happens. Everyone's attention is momentarily distracted by Martin's movement. Everyone, that is, except David, who has no interest in his grandfather and eyes only for the gun. So it is only he and Gavin who are looking directly at the stranger when he is hit in the chest at point-blank range by two barrels of shot. He has no memory of the noise because the sight is so extraordinary. It is like a huge, invisible airbag going off between the two men, lifting them and hurling them away from each other. The stranger's torso propelled by the shot, Gavin's torso propelled by the butt of the gun, which punches him hard in the ribs. He has seen this kind of image in films. What he has never seen in a film is the way the spray of shot passes instantly through the stranger's chest, shredding and liquidizing its contents and splashing them all over the curtains and the grandmother clock and the hand-coloured map of Bedfordshire while the stranger himself is still airborne. Then the stranger is no longer airborne. He is lying on the floor on his back, his head hard against the base of the clock, which is still rocking from the impact. His great coat spread to either side like a great pair of bat wings. Mirroring him on the opposite side of the central rug, Gavin too lies on his back, arms thrown to the side, unconscious, but with his eyes and mouth open, as if he has just noticed the amazing pattern of blood on the ceiling. A fat S of sulphurous grey smoke disperses slowly in the air between the two men.
Thank you.
Obviously it's slightly shocking, but I found myself almost laughing when I read that in the middle of it. Am I allowed to say this about my own writing?
You are.
It's very horrific, but then I paused to notice the grandmother clock and the hand-coloured map of Bedfordshire.
Yes. And could you read the next paragraph? I just feel that that carries on that detail so well with the kind of horror and the domestic detail.
Of course. Madeline screams. stops to catch her breath, then screams again, as if she is in a screaming competition. "Gavin," says Emmy, but she is wary of getting too close. "Gavin?" There is blood on the sofa. There is blood on the standard lamp. There is a growing pool of blood beneath the stranger's body. It is viscous with a plump, rounded outline, the colour of good port. There is blood on three of the dining chairs. There is a thin lasso of blood across the dining table, bisecting the cheese plate exactly. There is a little marble of blood sinking very slowly in a glass of Sauterne. Sophie has blood in her hair. She is wiping it robotically with a napkin, keeping her eyes fixed on the light switch on the far wall.
Thank you. And it's the cheese platter bisected by the line of blood that Gavin remembers when he starts having flashbacks.
Yeah, it's slightly, slightly nouvelle cuisine, isn't it?
It's very, yeah, it's very visual. Your writing is very visual.
As I was reading, I was realising that there is another thing that drives a lot of what I write, which is this desire to take something extraordinary, often from myth, from ancient literature, or from early literature, and say to myself, let's try and make that real. As it stands, it's a little broad brush, it's a little cartoony, it's a little cardboard. But what if that were really happening? And I think here I've done something similar to a scene you might see in a film. And it would be a little cartoony in a film. But it's a really interesting exercise to say, imagine it happens to real people. What would it be like to be in that scene?
And I think the other story that you mentioned that has a mythopoeic foundation, the island, has the same kind of reality to it. At one stage she scoops out a baby bird from its nest and eats it. And there's something really visceral about that. You really get a sense of that happening.
And I have to lock it into the real world, as I said. The baby bird, the island. Another way I made that story real, hopefully for the reader, but certainly for me, and this made it possible for me to write, is that in the original, she's dumped on the island of Naxos in the Mediterranean.
Yes.
I don't know Naxos, and I didn't feel at home making up this Greek island. So anyone who knows the area knows that it's Ariadne on Skoma. In fact, I just visited Skoma Island off the Pembrokeshire coast, a very magical place in and of itself.
Yes.
But I think one of the biggest breeding grounds of shearwaters in the UK. You have to take a little boat there. There's no one there for 6 months over the winter. I mean, I would happily visit every year. It's very charged with something for me. So I know it well, and it has heft and meaning for me. And because it's a story, I'm allowed to do exactly what I want.
Of course you are.
So, and as I just visited the place, and I had some pictures in my my scrapbook, that makes me sound like I'm 12, doesn't it? A bit of me is still 12, and I do still keep a scrapbook.
Absolutely.
I put tickets in there, I put photographs in there, and there's several pages devoted to Skoma. So I put the story there. Again, as I said earlier, I need a landscape. And
yes.
I save landscapes in order to use them like that.
And that had a real feeling of a Northern Ireland in that island story. You transformed the myth. It wasn't a Greek island. I wanted to go back to What Woe for a moment, because when we were in that very astonishing, I can only say astonishing scene, and it becomes even more astonishing when the stranger gets up with his chest completely blown out and walks off with "I'll see you next year," there are other subplots that really finely wrought, really beautifully drawn, the story of the two children, of a couple of the adult children, Sophie and Leo, have two children, David and Anya. And Anya runs off and hides, and we fear, the reader fears, that that's the true story. For a while it seems that that child will be lost, and she isn't lost. But the other child might be lost, and you leave that quite ambiguous, that David has gone on a decline, that the uncle, there's a flash forward there where the uncle Robert knows that the child will go into decline. He knows, he almost foresees what will happen, and the omniscient narrator tells us that something is going to happen to that boy. And then later on we see that he's experimenting with suicidal thoughts and games, and then at the end we see that when finally Gavin's standing at the door, David isn't in the room. And what I wanted to ask you about was when you decide in a story to move from the omniscience of the narrator to the actual inside of a character's consciousness, because we suddenly see things in that story from David's point of view, and so we feel very sympathetic towards that boy who feels himself to be an outsider.
in that sense, it's a story that's very, very different from the Pier Falls. The Pier Falls has one kind of godlike point of view from which we see absolutely everything. In Wadworth, certainly in the early scene with the family at Christmas, we move around between a lot of people's consciousnesses. Yes. That's something I've always really, really admired in Wolfe.
Mm.
And she does it best in To the Lighthouse.
Yeah.
I will never, ever be able to emulate her, but a little bit of her spirit is always sitting on my shoulder.
All right.
Pushing me. To move between the points of view of people within a room, but also to move in and out of time as well.
Yes.
I don't do it deliberately now, but I do it more often now. I think it's a bit like when you're a cook, you just, after a while, you just know what to throw in, and occasionally you need to throw a little bit of something else in.
Mm.
And I found that that's something I do more often, flashing forward.
Yes.
Foreshadowing, if you want
yes,
to call it.
Yes, foreshadowing.
And maybe that relates to some of the mythical stories I enjoy reading. That sense of fate, the sense that something lies ahead which cannot be avoided.
Yes.
And it's paradoxical, isn't it? On the one hand, we're often told when we're writing stories to leave everything mysterious so that we don't know what's going to happen next. That'll keep the reader on the edge of their seat. But I found rather, somehow accidentally, that in a slightly changed set of circumstances, knowing exactly what's going to happen next also keeps people on the front of their seat. It's the horror film logic, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Please don't go into that darkened room, but you know someone will.
And you want to know how it happens.
How the
two you want
connect.
To stay with the character as they go towards that fate.
Well, so as we were talking earlier, I realised something else lies behind, particularly that scene in the story, and that's the film Magnolia, which is by far and away my favourite ever film, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. Amazing cast. One of the things that's wonderful and idiosyncratic about it, which you see in almost no other films, is it's a complete ensemble piece. It has lots of plots running alongside each other and intertwining.
Mm-hmm.
I hope one day I'll manage to write a novel which emulates that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I never have, never quite will. But I always aspire to writing an ensemble piece like that. And there are very, very... I know that people have written collections of stories which sort of run in parallel and all locked together.
Yes.
I do like the idea of having people in a small location with all their separate stories running at the same time. It's hard to do, and there are very few novels in which it happens.
And somehow this story, which is the longest story, I believe, in the collection, it does happen because we weave in and out of these characters and we know exactly who they are.
Mm.
And their stories intertwine and they separate. And we know from the foreshadowing that some people will separate, the parents of those two children will separate eventually. And it gives you a kind of investment in all the characters, but keeps you somehow with the narrator as well. So I think for me, reading this collection of stories, I identified with the narrator too.
Hmm. Who might or might not be me.
Who might or might not be you.
And I'm not the person to answer that question.
No, of course not. But I felt it as a completely different experience, as you say, from most of the short stories I've read. So thank you very much for this work, Mark. It was a revelation to me.
Thank you.